publishing is just, it's such a strange beast as well, because like, you know, there's so many variables involved in what makes a book successful. And like, it's only partly down to like, I mean, obviously the quality of the book is like, and the way it's published is obviously a huge part of that. But it's also like, so much of it is about timing. Like timing is like, and you can't really control that. You can't really control, like, you can't control sort of the timing of a book's release in terms of what is popular at the moment and what might be popular in the future and what has been popular but suddenly isn't popular anymore. And I think I think that if you look at all of the massive, like, really, like, publishing moments, like, you know, like Da Vinci Code and Twilight and Hunger Games and all of these things, I think one thing that they all have in common, I think, is they came out at the right time. Like, and a certain set of variables came together and just aligned. And you know, because a lot of the time you can point to other examples of books in the same genre that might be like a lot better, or they might be this or they might be that, but they didn't have the same success, even though they came out just before or just after. And that's because they just didn't have that same set of variables just align exactly at the right moment. And I think, honestly, so much of success in publishing is down to that, and unfortunately you can't really control it.
What is up, everybody? You're listening to episode 101 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, MJ Kuhn. How's it going, MJ?
Hello. I am doing wonderfully. How are you?
Doing fantastic. We made it past 100 episodes.
We did. I know. It's exciting.
Even though we haven't recorded episode 100 because it's live, so this is like that weird like future past shit, but we did.
So actually, James, you are on our 100th episode. We are recording.
Yes.
I thought I was episode 100. So when Adrian was like 101, I was like, well, wait a minute, what's going on? So yeah, I'm just going to pretend this is episode 100. I'm just going to pretend it's 100. Technically it is, right? So
it's going to come from your heart and soul. It's episode 100.
Yeah. Inside, we know.
Inside. And before we kick things off, I got to pimp my girl's books, The Blue Baby, Among Thieves, and its thick ass brother, The Green Baby. If you're a fan of thieving and heists and all that fun stuff and hatchets, because MJ is a hatchet girl, then go pick up the Tales of Tamora duology. And it's a perfect fit, a perfect palate cleanser to get you in the mood for the Silver Blood Promise, which we'll be talking about today.
True. And also, I got a pimp my boy's book, Mushroom Blues, baby.
Also Blue Baby.
Also a Blue Baby. It's out. It's great. If you are interested in mushrooms and detective stories, police procedurals, a little bit of body horror, check this bad boy out.
Quite a bit of body horror, yeah.
I mean, it's nothing like too gross though, right? Like it's not, no. You know, it's just a little
smidge.
Bit.
A smidge. Yeah. As well, a quick note for listeners, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live, so go check that out in the description to support what we do here. Also, don't forget to rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast app. And subscribe to the FanFatic YouTube channel where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. Lastly, a quick shout out to our newest patron on Patreon, Mark R. Thank you for supporting the show. We appreciate you very much. And now, welcoming today's guest, James Logan, debut author of that book that I mentioned, The Silver Blood Promise. How are you doing, James?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, you can see around the corner. I spent a good few minutes just trying to make it, you know, just move it into prime position. I was really hoping it doesn't just like collapse and just topple onto my guitar or something.
It's a pretty thick book.
It's pretty, yeah. Well, if it lands on the guitar is definitely going to get crushed. So, you know, let's just hope that doesn't happen. But no.
Crash mid-recording.
There's like a thwang.
Hopefully not. Yeah, hopefully not. But no, I'm good. Thanks. Thanks so much for having me on. It's really exciting to be here with you guys. So.
Absolute pleasure. But we're going to start off with an introduction for listeners who aren't familiar with you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your experience in the industry?
Yeah, well, so I kind of go under, I sort of have two different hats. So James Logan is my writing pseudonym. So yeah, The Silver Blood Promise is my debut novel. I was listening to your episode with Sebastian D. Castell actually about swashbuckling fantasy, and I definitely think that Silver Blood would fit into that kind of swashbuckling kind of territory. I mean, I don't know. It's like epic fantasy is such a broad church, isn't it, really? But I think of it as like adventure fantasy, really, with like, you know, sword fights and cool magic and lots of action and intrigue and all the good stuff. But yeah, that's my debut novel. That's coming out April 25th in the UK and May the 7th in the US. So getting pretty close now, which is exciting. And then, yeah, in addition to that, also work in publishing. I have been doing so since 2010, working for Orbit, where I started as an editorial assistant. I've worked my way up now to senior commissioning editor. So I've been nearly 15 years on the front lines of, you know, science fiction and fantasy commissioning and editing and all the sort of million other things that that go on. So yeah, so it's interesting being kind of on the other, you know, with the writing being on the other side of the fence and kind of seeing things from the author's point of view, which, you know, I can maybe talk about a bit later, but it's definitely given me kind of like a really interesting insight into both sides of the industry and kind of how they work. And I've found that really useful and really interesting. So, yeah.
The front lines, indeed.
Mm. Yeah, well, the front lines, indeed.
as Scott Lynch described it, I met Scott at Worldcon when it was in London, and he signed my book, and he said he described it as the editorial salt mines. He actually wrote that in my book, editorial salt mines. I just thought that's great. Yeah, so it does sometimes feel like that.
But, yeah. Oh my gosh!
Oh, dude.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, you've got, I mean, all this experience on both sides of the fence now. So we like to look into our guest origin stories. What brought you into the world of sci-fi and fantasy? What made you want to pursue a career in writing and, you know, working on the publishing side of things? Do you remember the books, movies, games, anything like that kind of sparked your love for this genre?
Yeah, for sure. I think there's some that really stick out. I think the first, my first kind of brush with like the fantastical, as it were, I was always a really voracious reader as a kid. And like my parents would take me to the library every week and I just pretty much read anything. I was really just sort of not discriminating, just anything across all kind of different sort of genres. I mean, a lot of kids' stuff is fantastical in nature, I guess. It's why kids love monsters, don't they? So I think a lot of it is geared towards that. But the first thing I really remember is the kids' series, I think it was called Puddle Lane, actually. And it was like a series of kids reading books. And it was like this kind of like little country town, but it had loads of kind of magical things happening in it. And it was called Puddle Lane. And the author was Sheila McCullough. And Sheila McCullough also did another series called Tim and the Hidden People, which is also a kids reading series. And that one was about a young boy who finds a magical key that enables him to see the hidden people, who are like these kind of Napoleonic era kind of type characters who live out in a hollow hill in the woods. And there's all this kind of witch, and there's like demons inside tree stumps, and like there's bad hidden people and the good hidden people, and he kind of gets, you know, tangled up in all of that. And like, it was amazingly imaginative, both the series were, but like Tim and the Hidden People in particular just had like incredible illustrations. It was just so atmospheric. And I remember my mum was a teacher, so she had the full set. They're worth a fortune these days, and I don't know what happened to them. I did say to her at one point, I was like, do you still have them by any chance? Like, sadly not, but they go for like hundreds of pounds. Like, in, you know, individual books go for like 100, 200 quid or something. It's crazy. But like, I remember having like just sitting there in the classroom and my mum was tidying up or whatever, and I was just completely enraptured by these illustrations and these stories. And so that was kind of, I think, what sparked it, and it just sort of like maybe lay dormant for a while. And then the next moment I remember, like the significant moment, was Fighting Fantasy. I don't know if that was a thing in the US, but it was like, they're kind of like choose your own adventure type books. And they were huge in the UK in sort of the 1980s. And I kind of came into them at the tail end in sort of the mid 90s. But we had like a little catalog, like the school book club or whatever, that would come around every month or so, and you could order books from it, and they'd come in like 2 weeks later, and it was super exciting. And one week they had like, you know, one month they had, I think it was Return to Firetop Mountain, which is the 50th book in the series. They just had that in there, and for some reason I just homed in on that, and I wanted it. I can't even remember why, but I just wanted it, and it came in like 2 weeks later, and that was kind of it for me. Like, I was just immediately, I was in this fantasy world where I was the hero. I got to decide what to do. It was me in the story, and I think that's a really empowering thing for a kind of a kid, to kind of feel like you're actually the hero. And that was the whole point of the books, obviously. But you know, it was kind of early sort of D&D role play, like you roll dice to decide the fights, and you know, you have to choose what to do. If you want to punch the goblin in the face, go to page 60 or whatever it was, you know. And but like, also again, the illustrations, like there's like a visual element here. It's like the illustrations by Martin McKenna were just incredible, like just beautifully drawn, like super atmospheric. And again, I just got completely sucked in by this. So both, I think in both cases there was that visual element, which was really like clearly very important to me. But yeah, and that was kind of it for me. I never sort of looked back from there. I was just hooked on this kind of like fantasy and dragons and orcs and all that kind of stuff. And I think from there, it kind of, I veered into Redwall. I know you guys are big fans of Redwall. We've talked about that before. Yeah. I was really interested by that because I didn't think it had actually crossed the Atlantic. So clearly, like, that was really interesting. I thought it was just like a kind of beloved British series, but obviously it kind of went a lot further than that, which is awesome. But yeah, I read most of those. And then I think the next kind of like sort of major sort of point for me was just a friend saying, I think his dad bought him sort of Shannara by Terry Brooks, and he read it and was like, oh, hey, I think you'll like this. Why don't you, you know, so I went and got a copy and I read it, and I sort of burned through it in 2 days on holiday. And like, it's a big book, right? It's like, you know, it's a proper doorstopper. And I smashed through that in like a couple of days. And again, I was just like super, just completely captivated by it. Then that was kind of, that was my gateway, I suppose, into a sort of adult epic fantasy. And I just never looked back since then. I kind of read all the other stuff at the time that was being published. It was mostly white dudes, like, you know, Robert Jordan and Ray Feist and Tad Williams, big doorstopper, like proper epic fantasies, you know. And so that was kind of what I grew up reading. And that was really like, I think that was, yeah, that was, those kind of books are what cemented my kind of love of fantasy. I never kind of stopped reading it. But the actual idea of like maybe being a writer was not something that immediately was obvious to me. I think when you're a kid, you kind of like home in on, when you're thinking about a kid, it's really hard to think about what you might want to do, because the idea of like being an adult and having to have a job is just so alien to you when you're sort of like 14 or whatever, and just, you know. But I think you kind of home in on like the things that you're passionate about. And like books and fantasy was obviously a major one for me, but I was also super into like football. I was super into video games and music as well. And music was actually my main thing when I was a teenager. And that was what I really kind of creatively threw my energies into. So I like played in a band, and we like would record demos and we'd play gigs and stuff and just generally have an amazing time. But that was where I was sort of the main songwriter in it. So I was writing a lot of the music and like the lyrics as well. Terrible lyrics. I just remember one day my mum was like, oh, I found some of your lyrics. They're really good. And I was just like, just so embarrassed. Like, the way you can only be when you're a teenager and like your parents are just, I don't know. Yeah, that was
God,
just,
Mom, oh my get God. Out of here.
Get out of my room. Like, oh boy. Yeah, but like, I think that was where my main creativity outlet was, you know, being a songwriter and being a musician. And I kind of just like thought that that's what I was going to do, because, you know, obviously we were going to be rock stars and going to be millionaires and like that, you know, so I didn't really think about doing anything else. I was convinced that we'd all be rock stars and stuff. And then of course that didn't happen. And I think everyone goes through, like I certainly did, when you sort of, to some extent, you live in I suppose I'm sort of lucky enough to live in a kind of a bubble, but I did live in a kind of a little happy little bubble. And then at some point around the age of like, you're sort of 16 or 17 or 18 or something, that just bursts and you suddenly realize, oh no, actually this thing that I've just assumed is going to happen is not going to happen, and I'm going to have to do something else. And I think at that point, that was when the disillusionment with the music set in a little bit. And I think that was when I switched to writing, but it wasn't a conscious thing. It wasn't like I went, well, I'm not doing music anymore, I guess I'll do writing instead. But it wasn't like that. But I do think it was a subconscious thing. I do think on some level, my brain was like, oh shit, he's not doing the music anymore. We need to find something to distract him. Otherwise, this bad things are going to happen. Let's make him do some writing. But regardless, I found my way to it. And I had been thinking about writing before that. Interesting, I got a diary from that time. I was flicking through it the other day. And like, I mean, amidst all the really cringe stuff in there, there was like a little passage talking about how, oh, I'd really like to be a writer, that would be really cool. And like, you know, that was, I was definitely still in the band at that time, so it was you know, there was definitely some crossover. But yeah, it was when the band ended that I really started kind of pursuing the writing and started to think about, and it was kind of silly, I sort of pursued it with the same ridiculous confidence that I pursued the music. I just kind of assumed that, oh yeah, I can do this and I'm going to be a writer and it's going to be awesome. And like, I mean, at least that kind of came true a bit more than the music did, I guess, because I kind of am a writer now. So I suppose it worked, but you know, it's that.
I know,
that.
You are a writer. You have a book out, my dude.
Yeah, that's so is that ridiculous kind of confidence that you only have when you're like really young and fearless and you're a teenager and you just assume that it's going to be easy. But like, to some extent, I think that I kind of needed that, because otherwise I might never have started, you know. So having that just brazen confidence, I think, is actually really important. But I've kind of carried that through. I've always been really confident in my writing. Like, So, which is funny because I'm like, generally speaking, in terms of personality, like growing up, I was always like, you know, reasonably quiet and introverted. And like every school report I ever got said, James needs to speak more in class, you know, and every single, that came all the way through, even into my adult life. So I was always like, not the most confident, like kind of person or whatever, or most outspoken or whatever. But when it came to writing, I was always really super confident in it. Like that, it was just quite strange. It feels like a juxtaposition with the rest of my sort of my personality as I knew it. But I've always had that confidence. And I suppose that's kind of what kept me, like made me start writing and help keep me writing, I suppose, sort of over the years. So yeah, that's my origin.
I think that maybe the lack of like extroverted confidence is like, writing is a good way for introverts to kind of express their confidence. Cause it's like 100%. You choose when you show it to somebody else, you know,
you can prepare, get all of your stuff together and nobody has to like be aware of what you are, exactly. What you feel, what you're going to say until you've had a chance to, you know, hone it.
Absolutely. And it's like, I'm the kind of person that like, will, if I have to make an important phone call, I'll like write out the phone call before I do it. Like, which is crazy. Right. But like, this, the idea of like picking up a phone and calling someone just freaks me out slightly. So I've got better at it over the years. Like, but I will literally write out these scripts and like, so when you have the call, you're presenting your kind of ready-made thing. But I suppose books is a bit like that. Writing is a bit like that. No one gets to see behind the scenes really. And what you present to the world is kind of the finished thing, and no one sees all the screw-ups and like the multiple, well, you hope they don't. I know there's at least one in Silver Blood Promise, which I literally found yesterday, and I was like, oh boy, how did that survive 12 rounds of edits? I don't know how that got through, but you know, that's cool.
It always does.
There's always something.
Cause like you got to see the other, you've been able to see over the last like 14 years, the other side of it. In which case it's like throughout that you've been writing your own stuff, but then you've been seeing how other authors kind of express their own sort of confidence through their writing. And so it's like, as an editor and reading so many manuscripts, how did that experience kind of influence your writing process and kind of get you prepared for the eventuality that you're now at, which is being a debut author?
I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Like, because you hear a lot of authors kind of say, oh, I don't like to read fiction while I'm writing a new book because I don't want to be influenced by it, or I don't want to accidentally kind of pick up things from it and whatnot. I kind of didn't have a choice because I have to read these things for my day job, you know? So like I couldn't just be like, oh, I'm not going to read any novels for like 6 months or whatever. I literally have to do that. But funnily enough, I've never felt like I was being, I've only ever found that kind of inspiring, and I still do. Like I still, you know, even though I have to read novels for my day job and I spend a lot of my free time writing, I still love reading for pleasure. Like I just find it really, nothing inspires me more than reading someone else's work when they've really smashed it. And I'm just like, yeah, this is how you do it. Like I kind of felt like that. I just finished reading Empire of the Damned by Jay Kristoff, and it's the kind of book you come away from, you're just thinking, why am I bothering? Cause this is just so damn good. And I can never write something as good as this. And, but yeah, after you get over that initial kind of like, why am I bothering kind of thing, you just kind of, it fires you up, or it fires me up, because I just kind of think that is the kind of level that I want to hit. I want to be able to kind of have epic plots like that and that kind of sophistication in my character work. And, you know, so for me, I just find it really inspiring, and I always have. And so I've never had kind of a problem sort of trying to juggle the day job reading of manuscripts with my own kind of creative work in my spare time. I think what I found more difficult was, for a while, I just felt like, oh, I'm in publishing now. I'm an editor. So that means I probably shouldn't be a writer, which is kind of ridiculous, because like every other person in publishing is writing a novel, right? So like the reason we all work in publishing is because we love books. And of course, a lot of us want to be writers. So it's completely not an uncommon thing at all. But for a while, I kind of struggled under that illusion that, oh, I maybe shouldn't be doing this. But it was also, it was also kind of a point in my life where I was sort of, you know, moving to London for the first time and had loads of other stuff going on. And so it wasn't really, you know, so I wouldn't write a huge amount during those kind of early years. I think there was a few abandoned kind of attempts where I did the usual thing, which is something that I had done sort of ever since university, of writing, like now and again I would come back to it and be like, right, I'm gonna finally write this novel, and then I'd kind of get like 40,000 words in and I just abandon it. And I did this over and over again, and this is like, without wanting to go off on a tangent, because like writing advice obviously is a totally different thing, but like the one thing I would say to people is really, or to writers, you know, young writers, new writers, is like, try and finish what you start, because I think that is a lesson I wished I had learned so much earlier. Because I spent the better part of 15 years just writing the first thirds of novels and then abandoning them. And guess what happened? I got really, really good at writing the first third of novels and then just couldn't, sucked at doing the rest. And it's funny because Silverblood's the first book I have actually written all the way through. So and that's why it was so damn hard as well. I can get onto that, but like, because that's more about writing process. But like, yeah. So, since university, I just kind of had these occasional sort of do a new manuscript and then just give up, and that kind of went on for a long time, better part of a decade or something. And yeah, and then like obviously the writing kind of fell away a little bit when I joined Orbit and was kind of like working on my editorial career. But I think it did kind of get to a point in 2015 where it would have been 2014 actually, when I just sort of thought to myself, I don't want to be one of these people that talks about doing something and never does it. Like we've all met people like that who, you know, like,
especially with writing a novel.
It's like, yeah,
every person that finds out you're a writer says that.
Yeah. And I just didn't want to be one of the people that says I'm going to do this and then just, you know, cause I've done my time in retail. I've worked in retail, and a lot of the people who are kind of stuck in retail cause like the job sucked or whatever. And you know, a lot of them would be like, I'm going to get out, I'm going to do something. And like 5 years later, you go back to the shop or whatever, and they'd still be there. Like, and you just feel kind of bad for them because they've clearly not made good on that thing that they were going to do. And I didn't want to do that. I really wanted to, I had this sort of desire and this dream of being a writer, being a fantasy author, like since I was a teenager. And I think by 2014, I just kind of thought, I just got to make good on this now. Because I was in my 30s by that point. And I just kind of, when you hit milestones like that, you do kind of think it's a moment, it is quite normal to kind of reflect on where you are and things. And what I realized was I spent most of my 20s screwing up and just making a mess of things. And I kind of figured that, you know, my 30s would be trying to correct those errors and also try and make good on that sort of promise. And so that's why I decided that 2015 was going to be the year when I would do that. And so that's when I kind of started writing it. But I suppose to answer the question, like, I think it was only a good thing, sort of. I think maybe some people would find it difficult, like being an editor, because you might feel certain resentment that like these people are having their books published and you're not. But I honestly never felt like that, because as a writer myself, I knew how hard it is to write a book. I knew the kind of the commitment and the struggle it could be. And so I never felt kind of aggrieved that when, you know, someone's book would come out, even if I didn't particularly rate it myself or particularly like it. Like, I'm not talking necessarily about Orbit, just any book in general in publishing. Because obviously all Orbit books are amazing, obviously, it goes without saying. I'm not even joking. They are all awesome. I never felt that kind of, I was just really pleased to be in publishing and to kind of have that as a career, because I'd spent ages working in kind of an office in a role that I just really hated. And so to be in publishing and be surrounded by books and be surrounded by people that love books. And that's such an inspiring environment. And it's a shame. I mean, this is a whole other topic that I won't like dive deeply into, but it's, you know, a lot of the view of publishing from the outside. And I understand this to an extent, because it can be quite opaque at times. It's not the most transparent industry, though it is a lot better now, I think, than it was when I joined. But a lot of the time the view is kind of like, oh, it's greedy publishers, and you know, they're doing this and they're screwing the authors over, and it's all done on purpose. And it's, you know, I'm not saying that bad things don't happen sometimes, but like on the kind of ground floor of publishing, there's just so many people that love books and work so hard and just want the books to succeed because they want the authors to succeed. And they are like the best people to work with. And it's a shame sometimes when, you know, you kind of see the whole evil publisher shtick, and it's just kind of like, actually, like 99% of people in publishing are really awesome, yeah, and just love books and just want
That's the thing. There's like, it's the inability to differentiate. And I've heard tons and tons of horror stories through publishing.
Oh, of course. Thing, yeah.
The one through line that I've heard, the individuals that I've worked with.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But then it's like on like an executive level or a corporate level, things happen that you can't really control.
I've had a bit of a rough go in the publishing world, but every single person that I have spoken to, met with, had a call with, whatever, that's been at my publishing houses has been just like the most passionate, wonderful, kind people. It's just, you know, it's a big dinosaur system that sometimes things get confusing.
I think it's the problem. You know? I think it's the problem of really passionate people that want to do right by the book and right by the author, often just being constrained by budgets, by systems, by someone else's expectations or lack of expectations, you know. And yeah, it can be difficult, and also publishing is just, it's such a strange beast as well, because there's so many variables involved in what makes a book successful, and like it's only partly down to like, I mean obviously the quality of the book is like, and the way it's published is obviously a huge part of that, but it's also like so much of it is about timing is like, and you can't really control that, you can't control sort of the timing of a book's release in terms of what is popular at the moment and what might be popular in the future and what has been popular but suddenly isn't popular anymore. And I think that if you look at all of the massive publishing moments, like, you know, like Da Vinci Code and Twilight and Hunger Games and all of these things, I think one thing that they all have in common, I think, is they came out at the right time. Like, and a certain set of variables came together and just aligned. And you know, because a lot of the time you can point to other examples of books in the same genre that might be like a lot better, or they might be this or they might be that, but they didn't have the same success, even though they came out just before or just after. And that's because they just didn't have that same set of variables just align exactly at the right moment. And I think, honestly, so much of success in publishing is down to that, and unfortunately you can't really control it. So, you know, it's a strange kind of game to work in, because you're working on books, and I've worked on many books that I thought were terrific and just didn't quite find the audience they deserved. And it's not because I didn't work hard on them, it's not because it's not a good book, it's not because we didn't publish it in a really good way, it's just because at that moment in time there was something going on in the market, or something was happening, it just didn't quite connect, it didn't quite land, and there's not really a lot you can do about that. So there's so much of that in publishing, unfortunately, that you just kind of have to accept. And, you know, it's why great books sometimes don't find the audience they deserve, and it's why not so great books can be massive. Like, you know, it makes it an interesting kind of quite dynamic sort of industry to work in, I guess, from that point of view.
Because on one hand, it's not just timing. It's like it could be the right time for a book that isn't wholly original even, but then it could be like a wholly original book that just didn't find the right timing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I think publishing is littered with kind of like sort of good examples of that. And stuff that is just slightly ahead of the curve and, you know, just, it wasn't the right moment. Like, and that happens, you know, so, but anyway, generally it's like, I think, I still, like, I've been in publishing nearly 15 years now, but like still finding like a new author kind of come into my inbox and you read it and get excited by it. That's still such a great feeling. And being able to, I did this the other day, I signed something new, and being able to kind of make like email the agent or whatever and make the offer is like just one of the best feelings, because you know you're like making someone's kind of dreams come true kind of thing, like, you know, being totally serious about it. And like, that's such a great feeling to be able to do that. I wish I could do it more, but you know, we do have to be really super selective about, you know, what we take on and stuff, but it's a great feeling when you are able to do it, and just seeing particularly also like some of my authors I've worked with for over a decade, and just seeing their career kind of grow over the decade and stuff is just super satisfying. Not just on a personal level, because I feel like I've played my small part in that, but also just seeing them get the attention they deserve or whatever and kind of go from strength to strength is such a gratifying feeling. And I think, you know, being in a day job is like where you get that kind of satisfaction from it, and feeling like you're actually doing something worthwhile is just super important, I think, to just generally feeling like you're spending your time wisely and doing something worthwhile. So yeah, it's awesome.
I love that. Well, let's dive into the Silver Blood Promise a little bit more, because we haven't talked about it too much yet. So the book, it's fast-paced fantasy tale. It's got
can I give my like comps?
Oh, it's, yeah, like, yeah, go for it.
Yeah. Indiana Jones meets the Lies of Locke Lamora.
What
immediately came to mind after I read the book.
That's yeah, no, that, that's
but like
yeah.
specifically The Last Crusade.
Last Crusade, that's really interesting, because I'll die on this hill, or at least put up a really determined.
Okay, well, like the element of Last Crusade where it involves his dad.
You know, what I was going to say was Last Crusade is my favorite indie film by some distance. It's really interesting that you kind of picked that out, because it's not a connection that I made, but looking at it now, it's like, oh, of course, yeah, that's really obvious, isn't it? Like, I'm totally, here's me thinking, oh, I've come up with this really cool original story. And it's like, actually, no, it's just clearly a mishmash of all these things I've just like inhaled over the last 20 years. But no, I mean, I love that film. I think I genuinely think it's the best film, indie film, but not just the best indie film, but also just like one of the best action adventure films ever. And I think Indiana Jones meets Locke Lamora is, I mean, yeah, I love Locke Lamora as well. I love Scott Lynch. I know you guys are a big fan as well, or big fans. I actually got a quote from Scott. It's on the front of the UK edition of Silver Blood, which like just blew my mind when
that on Instagram and was
how
like,
did they not put that on the US one either?
The US one had just gone to print because it came in quite late in the day. So we managed to squeeze it. I know my UK editor had to like run to production and like beg to get the cover back so they could add it. And like production generally don't like it when you take things back from them. Like, so yeah,
it was, you know, the presses.
Yeah.
Fucking stop it.
So we managed to get it in, but like that was just a really surreal moment to kind of get a quote from Scott. Like just knowing that he had read the book and liked it was just kind of mind blowing. And because he's obviously such a huge influence. I think anyone who reads Silver Blood and has read Liza Lottimore will probably realize that he's a huge influence, like just on the book. And I think reading Liza Lottimore in 2006, and I think this was I talked earlier about reading those big fat epic fantasies of in like the 1990s, but like I think the second part of my kind of fantasy sort of education, as it were, or whatever, was like in the kind of mid sort of 2000s when, you know, the first law, Job Crombie, Blade itself came out, and Liza Lottimore came out in the same year, which is incredible. Like what year that was. But like, I think both of those two like books were like quite fundamental to me because they really turned fantasy upside down, or my perception of what fantasy could be. And like already it changed a little bit because obviously you had like Game of Thrones, and Game of Thrones was like really quite dark. And obviously like, you know, the closest thing they have to a hero gets killed in the first book. So already I feel like Game of Thrones was kind of like playing around with these established tropes of like the hero's journey and things like that. But like Liza Lottimore just kind of came out of nowhere and was just like so different to anything else I'd read. And it was, and you know, I think Blade itself was a little more familiar because like it was very deliberately riffing on kind of established tropes and turning them upside down. And that was part of the kind of fun of it. But Liza Lottimore was just, you know, it was kind of eye-opening for me because I was just reading it and I was like, wait a minute, you can write this kind of thing. This is also fantasy, but like, it's nothing like what I've read before. Not to say that that kind of thing doesn't exist within the genre, because it obviously does, because you can go back to stuff like Fritz Leiber and, you know, Fafhrd and Grey Mouser, and that is very much sword and sorcery kind of city-based adventure. And I think that's one of the influences on Scott's work. But like seeing it published in this way and becoming so massively popular was definitely not something that I had seen before. And it just made me realize that fantasy didn't all have to be kind of like square-jawed heroes fighting Dark Lords. It could actually be these kind of rogue type characters getting into trouble in the seedy underbelly of a city, and didn't need to have magic swords in it, didn't need to have dragons in it, it didn't even need to leave the kind of singular location that it's set. And it also kind of introduced to me, I guess, the concept of the city as a character in its own right, which I'm not sure I'd ever really seen before. So like that, yeah, so I mean, Liza Lottimore was just a fundamental text. And then, yeah, Indy, obviously, just, I'm just a huge kind of, I'm obviously a fantasy author, but like, what I think I also am is just, I just really like adventure stories, and I've always grown up reading adventure stories. And I sort of think of myself as writing adventure stories, but they just happen to be in a fantasy setting in a way. Cause I love fantasy as well, obviously, but it's that whole kind of like people on a quest, people on an adventure. I think maybe because I was, like I said, quite sort of introverted as a kid, reading about people going out and doing these big adventures was how I kind of like got a bit of that experience, because I'm sure not going to do it myself, like, you know. But I think that was quite sort of influential and one of the reasons I connected it with so much is the idea of these people going off on this grand adventure, which I just scarcely could imagine doing. And so, like, I think just, yeah, obviously Indiana Jones is like one of the best kind of examples of that. And so, yeah, I had never thought of it like Liza Lottimore meets Indiana Jones, but that to me is like the perfect, I might just have to write that down. So the next time I must explain the book, I'm just going to say, well, actually I have got a good kind of elevator pitch.
This is my elevator pitch for it now. Yeah.
You mentioned about our episode with Sebastian like on swashbuckling, and like Indiana Jones for me is like quintessential swashbuckler.
Pretty good squash.
Yeah.
Such a fucking good swashbuckler. And you know, like you set up this world with like, quite a lack of square jaws, and you know, like disgraced nobles, and
plenty of not so many square jaws, plenty of weak chins and things like that.
Oh my god, I love that though. But you did create this really quintessential swashbuckler for your story, which is your main character, Lucan. And we're gonna dive deeper into sort of like the intersection between character and world in our masterclass, but what was your character building process like, and how did you create Lucan and just kind of like embody these things, like this adventurous spirit that you kind of grew up with and loved,
yeah,
and put that into him?
It's an interesting one. A lot of these questions are like really interesting but quite hard to answer, because I've worked on the book for so many years that I can hardly remember how it started, you know. So it's slightly blurry, but I know that Lucan has been a character in my head for a long, long time, and I know he appeared in other manuscripts that I abandoned over the years in various guises. He wasn't always in the guise he is now. I think in one manuscript he was kind of this like sort of mercenary type, soldier type, and that just didn't work out. And he was also about 10 years older. So he's sort of existed, and the name has been in my head for a long time, and he has existed as an entity in my head for a long time. And I think it was just a case of finding the right fit for him, kind of finding what worked. Now, I tried different things and nothing quite worked. And then giving him a spin as kind of this lapsed aristocrat with kind of like, you know, a first class honors degree in sarcasm, and, you know, just who has all these kind of issues, like drinking too much, a terrible family relations, you know, all of these kind of flaws. But also, like a good heart and a good kind of sense of moral sort of, you know, right and wrong and so on. And then I just guess something just clicked there. I think very quickly it just suddenly, I think when I was writing it, I just very quickly felt like this feels right to me. Like this feels like a character I want to explore and feels like someone that would be fun to spend time with. Obviously we'll talk about, I know we're doing sort of another conversation about rogues and things like that. I'm going to talk more about that then, but like writing this kind of character just felt far more interesting to me than writing him as kind of like, I don't know, a straight up kind of soldier type or something, because having the kind of personality he does, like, it just gives you so many more avenues to kind of like explore certain things and also different directions you can push the story in, I think. I think the best characters, I guess I'm drawn to kind of smart characters who kind of will use their intellect and their wits to kind of get what they want. That to me is more interesting than someone just smashing a huge oversized weapon into someone's skull or whatever. I mean, that's cool too. For me, it's like seeing people manipulate behind the scenes or just kind of using their wits to kind of change a situation to their advantage. For me, is more interesting. And I think as a storyteller, it offers you more opportunities to do something interesting with a scene or with a plot, you know, kind of development. So I don't know, like it's hard to really explain, but like Lucan just felt right. It just, this kind of, I've tried him in many different kinds of glove, and this one is the one that just sort of slipped on and felt like it fitted right. And then it was, yeah, it's just a case of then after that, just kind of letting sort of him do his thing. And Flea, actually, his kind of, well, I would call her a sidekick, but she would punch me in the face, I think. And it's probably an injustice to describe her like that, but she also was in my head for a long time, for decades. I remember writing the two of them in a completely different kind of novel, which I may go back to one day, but I remember writing those two characters in slightly different guises, and that was like that was like 2007 or 2008, so they've been in there a long time. Flea was originally a boy called Rat, but otherwise was exactly the same as she is now, and for the purpose of this book I just gender flipped her, because that just seemed, I think changing gender just gave that their relationship that extra dynamic, you know, the kind of like young girl, older guy kind of thing. And almost like, I just found it fun that you'd have this like this girl pushing this older guy around and basically like being the boss of him. I thought that was really fun, and it just added that extra dynamic to the relationship. But again, it was that bantery kind of feel. Again, was just, it just felt right. And I think if you've read the book, I think you'll realize that like their kind of bantery relationship kind of is the heart almost that the whole novel pivots around in a way. I mean, obviously there's like bigger kind of plot things going on and stuff and mysteries and whatnot, but I feel like their relationship is kind of the glue that holds the whole thing together. And I think right from the start that felt extremely natural and just felt like it worked. And so really, I think once you've, for me, like writing is about, books are about well, I'm trying to think how best to say it. Stories for me are about people, and I will always be drawn to books that have really strong characters, that just like your character led kind of stories with really, really strong protagonists. And I suppose that's why for me it was really important to kind of get the characters right. And once I had felt like I got them right with their kind of relationship, once that clicked into place, everything kind of just built from there. So I guess that was the starting point, really, was that relationship and getting it right, getting Lucan right, and then bringing Flea in and just getting them to click. And once that was done, it just kind of rolled from there. But for other people might start with like world building. Before I did start writing the book, I did kind of do a lot of world building. I did the classic thing of like going to coffee shops and being like, hey, yes, I'm a writer. I'm just going to sit here and drink my coffee and like look important and scribble in my book, which
that accent too.
It adds a level to it.
So I did that for a while, but I did quite a lot of the world building, like just kind of fleshing out I knew quite early on that I wanted each book to take place in a different city, because I thought that would keep it interesting for the reader, but also it would stop me from getting bored, because each time I'd be able to explore a different setting and bring in different world building elements and that kind of thing. So I just kind of thought, okay, I want like a series with an overarching story, but we're going to have each book in a different setting. So I kind of spent a lot of time thinking about the different cities and the geography and the politics and what makes each city unique. What is it that gives it its character? And then you're able to then really lean into that character in terms of the plot, you know. So for Sophrona, obviously, where the first book takes place, it's all about kind of trading and wealth and merchant princes and being a kind of a trading center. And, you know, quite a lot of the book leans quite heavily into that in terms of the characters who are involved and the different kind of like the power structures and all that kind of thing. So in a way I did kind of start with the world building, but it was really, I think, the characters that very quickly proved to be the momentum behind the story, and that's what kind of drove it forwards, I think. And because I'm such a character based kind of like both reader and writer, I always, you know, the character's the most important thing for me, so getting that right was crucial. And once I did, I think it just kind of rolled from there. So
MJ and I are both very much character driven writers.
100%. Well, and even reading the book, you know, you can tell I love the dynamic. I agree as just like a reader, the relationship dynamic between Lucan and Flea does I would follow the two of them on an adventure to the grocery store. Like, their dynamic together is so fantastic.
Arguing over like which kind of like flavor of ice cream to buy.
I mean, literally though, it's that kind of thing where it's like their dynamic is compelling enough that the plot is fantastic as well, but they could carry any plot, you know what I mean?
They feel like a brother and sister, like, by the end of the book.
Yeah, and I think big age gap. There's a big age gap. But I think it does lean into that. I think it does lean into that kind of brother sister kind of dynamic. And they've both obviously like had sort of suffered sort of, I think, tragedies in their past relating to family, and which seems to be a recurring theme as well, because Ashra, obviously, who's a character comes in later, has also suffered the same thing. So I don't quite know where this is coming from, because I thought I've been very lucky not to have any major kind of family dramas or like, you know, people being murdered on in real life. So I'm super, super fortunate. But so I don't quite know where that comes from. But like, yeah, no, I think there is that kind of brother sister thing going on. But it's also just the kind of the banter. I love humor. Most of the humor in the book, I think, comes from the two of them. And humor is such a kind of important thing for me, because I've kind of realized, I think one of the ways that my tastes maybe have changed over the years in terms of reading fantasy and what I like and maybe what I don't, is I kind of struggle with books that don't have a sense of humor now. It's something that just is a bit serious and like maybe takes itself a bit seriously. I just can't quite get on board with it. Like, I need at least a little bit of humor just to keep the tone, just to keep it balanced, just to kind of, you know. And I think that's maybe why Liza Lotlamora and The Blade itself were so kind of impressed so much on me at the time, is because they're both really funny. Like, they're really kind of violent and dark in their own way. And both of them are quite gritty sort of like stories in their own right, but they're also really funny. And like, I think that's what impressed me so much at the time, or what I was really left with. I didn't realize that fantasy could be funny like that. I'd certainly never really read anything like that. But I think humor is such a like intrinsic part of the human experience, and I just think that it's just something that I think is really kind of just important, and I love to kind of see in fiction, and I wanted to have it in my own, and it was really important to me. I just love a good bit of humor in a book. And I think for me, that in my own work, that's where it kind of comes from. So I suppose they're kind of, they act as a foil in that regard as well, because of their bantery kind of relationship, and a lot of the humor kind of comes from them. So it kind of, it sort of serves that purpose as well, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, readers, a lot of readers, myself and a bunch of people I know, love the humorous element. And I think that a lot of people, from what I've seen, I feel like I'm seeing the Silver Blood. I'm seeing it everywhere online. There's so much buzz. It feels like it's very highly anticipated. We talked a little bit about this before we started recording, but I'm curious, how does it feel to have your work generate so much excitement? Are you feeling pressure? Are you feeling excited? Is it a mix of both? How are you kind of managing your launch preparation with all this?
Yeah, I mean, it's been an amazing journey, like, to be honest, because it took me, like, I started writing Silver Blood in 2015, and it wasn't until about, it took me about 7 years to kind of arrive at a draft that I felt was ready to go out. And, I was very fortunate in that I kind of got an agent like almost immediately, which was just super lucky. It was because my good friend Anne Perry was previously in publishing, kind of working for Simon & Schuster, and then she went on maternity leave. And then when she came back, she decided she wanted to go into agenting, and she just contacted me out of the blue. And this was, I feel like this whole, my whole kind of journey is made up of these small little moments that just feel like the universe lining up and just going, I'll go on then, like, I'll do you a favor. And, you know, but I literally just finished the manuscript and was ready to kind of think about, okay, well, what agents might I want to work with, and who might be interested in this. And then Anne just emailed me out of the blue and was like, hey, so I'm going to become an agent. I know you're writing something. So do you want to send it to me? And so I was like, okay. And so I did. And then, like, literally a few days later, she just emailed back and was like, I love it. This is amazing. Can I represent you? So yeah, so that was just completely wild and like not normally how it happens, you know? And, I feel a bit guilty when I kind of tell that story, because I know that some people like spend years trying to get an agent, and it can be such a difficult struggle. So I super lucked out in that regard. But then, you know, like we went out on submission, and I was really determined I wanted to kind of do this properly, whatever that means. I'm still not entirely sure what that means, but I kind of felt like, I suppose what I mean is, I wanted the book to, if it was going to be picked up, I wanted it to be because someone connected with the book, not because of like, it was the fact that me who wrote it, not that that would necessarily be an advantage. Like, it might, you know, it was hard to know whether going out under my real name would be an advantage or a disadvantage, because it's like, you know, on the one hand, it might make people think, oh, okay, well, he's an editor, he must really know his stuff. You know, on the other hand, they might be thinking, oh God, I don't want to work with another editor. Like an editor masquerading as an author, like, cause they're going to, you know, so I wasn't really sure like whether it'd be a good thing or a bad thing. And in the end, I wanted the focus to be firmly on the book and not the person who had written it. So I went out under a pseudonym, and we went out on submission, and we spent 18 months kind of in the submission trenches, which was an amazing experience. Not at the time, it sucked at the time, but now it's like, I'm really grateful to have had that, because I really got the firsthand experience of what it is like to be an author out in the trend, out on submission, and like the grueling emotional kind of roller coaster that is, because you go out on sub and you're like really excited, and then just like the days and then weeks go by and nothing happens, and you're kind of like faint hope of like maybe we could get like a six-figure preempt, you never know, that's just gone, and you're kind of like, okay, cool, no, that's always unlikely, so that's fine. But then, like, you know, the more time goes by, the more twitchy you get. And then the rejections start coming in. And, well, you know, the way it worked for me was like, the early rejections were kind of like, you know, we really love this, but it's just not quite what we want right now. So, and you kind of take them, you're like, okay, that's cool. At least they liked it. So that's really cool. The trouble is, like, a year later, when you're still getting them and everyone's saying, this is really good, but we don't want it, it's just, that becomes quite frustrating, because, you know, because you realize that the book is good, the quality, it's good enough. It's just that no one, it's not quite what anyone wants right now for whatever reason. I think we went out at a time when the market was shifting more towards, firstly, you know, authors from diverse backgrounds and, you know, underrepresented authors. There's a big focus on that at the time, and quite right, because goodness knows, you know, fantasy been dominated by white men for so long. But we kind of went out at the time when there was a real focus on that, and also just when fantasy was moving more away from the grimdark stuff to cozy stuff, romantic and things like that. Yeah. And so we just spoke about timing, right? Like, so in terms of me going out on sub, it probably wasn't the best time for the kind of thing that I'd written, but you can't really control that. So anyway, after we had some near misses, but in the end, no one bit. So after 18 months, like, we were kind of left with nothing. And at that point I was gonna self-publish it because I really believed in the book. I felt like the feedback we'd had was, you know, was really positive, and that I believed in the book. I felt the book was good enough, and I kind of felt like the other choice was to kind of write something else, and I just couldn't quite bear to let go of it because I'd spent like 7 years working on it, and you know, I really believed in it. So I thought, okay, you know, I wanted the traditional deal, but never mind, let's self-publish it, because I feel as a publishing professional, I'm pretty well placed to have a good crack at this. Like, I know how to write marketing copy, I know how to write kind of back cover copy, I know like what a good title is, I know kind of this, I know how to brief a cover. I felt like I was well equipped to do it, and obviously there's loads I still had to learn, but I thought I would give it a go. And so I did. I started kind of like going down that path. I commissioned the cover, you know, which is the one that you see on the final book, because fortunately my publishers really loved it. So yeah, I started working on the cover, started doing all the other things that you need to do. And then that was the point at which my agent rang me and was like, okay, so I've got some good news and bad news. The bad news is I can't be your agent anymore because I'm quitting agenting. So you're just kind of like, okay, cool. Like, you know, 18 months on sub, no one's bitten, and now I've lost my agent. So this is working out really well. Cool.
Oh, no.
You know, but then Anne said, the good news is I'm joining, you know, Joe Fletcher Books as publisher, and I want to take the book on. So, and I, funny enough, I just didn't grasp what that meant at the time. So I was just kind of like, okay, cool. Yeah. Wait a minute, you know, like, you just, what do you say? You know, it just totally didn't sink in. And I think I can't really remember the conversation there, but I think I said to Anne, okay, I'll just have to think about it. And then I just put the phone down. I was like, wait a minute, what am I thinking about? So instantly phoned back. I was like, okay, yeah, is the offer still on the table? You know, so that's kind of weird because like, in terms of a route into publishing as an author, like that's a really strange one. Like having your agent quit being your agent and then buying your book. Like I've not heard of that one before. That's quite a unique one. It's a new one. Yeah. It's an interesting one. If this was like a video game, it would be like a legendary kind of route into publishing or something, but it would have the gold kind of tag on it, like legendary weapon kind of things. It's just like, it's just so stupidly rare. So sorry, I can't even imagine. What was your original question? Cause I've just gone on a total tangent here. What was the original question?
Which is how, I mean, this has been a great tangent though, because it is always so interesting because everybody we've talked to has a completely different path to publication. But just how are you handling your launch preparation?
Yes. Sorry, this has been off on a total tangent. But no, I think the point I was trying to make in a very roundabout way, but I do think that's quite an interesting kind of story just because it's such a random route into publishing. But I think the point I was trying to make is like, I think it's quite easy to maybe look at me and kind of think, oh, well, he's in publishing, so of course he'd get a publishing deal. Like, it must have been easy. And it's like, actually, no, it wasn't. Like, 18 months in the trenches, 7 years working on this book, and then 18 months in the sub trenches and getting nothing. I feel like I've done the hard yards. Like, and I'm proud that I've done that. Like, and I'm grateful that I've done it. And even though it kind of sucked at the time, the experience that I went through, like, was so useful to me as an editor, because now I know what it's like for most authors. Now, obviously, not everyone goes through that. Some people get deals very quickly, which is great. But I think most authors probably go through something similar like that, in terms of having to wait and wait and wait, and oh, someone's really interested and suddenly they're not interested anymore, you know. So it is really tough, and so it's been quite a wild ride to this point, but I think that just kind of to now be in this situation, like where I was like 2 years ago, basically with no one being interested and I'm going to self-publish it, to now be in this position where, you know, we've got two like big five publishers on both sides of the Atlantic going out with it. And it's, you know, it's getting all the cool marketing and people seem really excited about it. And we had proofs, we had this, we had that. And I got the Scott Lynch quote and we got the Broken Binding special edition. You know, all of these things are just absolutely mind blowing to me, because if you told me 2 years ago that this would be happening, I wouldn't have believed you, because it was just so far. I felt so far away from that point. So I'm really just at the moment, everything is just great. Like everything that happens is just, it's like, it just feels my goal really, like all I ever wanted was to write a book and have it published. And I've now kind of achieved that, or will have achieved that in a couple of weeks when it comes out. But that was all I really wanted, was to have that happen and to be able to walk into a bookstore and see my book on the shelf. That was it for me. So anything on top of that is just like bonus material, you know? But yeah, like to kind of see the beautiful Broken Binding edition with the artwork, and to see people getting so excited and stuff, like it's, Yeah, I mean it's really great. We actually did our first I can't talk about it yet, but we did our first translation deal recently as well, which is just awesome. Mm-hmm. It's just so cool, right? Like to think that someone liked my book enough to want to translate it in different languages is just wild. And so yeah, no, it is super exciting, and I'm super grateful and really happy that all this is happening, and I'm just so happy that people are excited. I had a conversation with my brother like a couple of years ago. We were heading home for Christmas, and at this point, I think this at this point, kind of, I knew that like Anne was going to take the book on, but or at least try to take the book on, but it hadn't happened yet, and there was a bit of a delay until that happened. So it was basically I found out in like the summer that this would be happening, but it wasn't until like January the following year that the deal was done. So I had like the six longest months ever waiting for it to happen. Like, yeah, but I remember that Christmas in the middle of that period, kind of going down, or towards the end of that period. You know, heading home for Christmas, and I remember talking to my brother about it, because my brother is also an author. He's a very successful children's book author, whose series is becoming being made into a TV series, which is just super awesome. Nice. So,
cool.
Yeah, it's wild. It's so cool. I'm really happy for him. But I was talking to him about it, because obviously fellow creative, he's, you know, in the real sort of industry, and he knows kind of the ups and downs of it. And he kind of said to me, like, what would success look like to you? And I said to him, I just want people to read my book and enjoy it. And that's still true now. Like, I just, you know, all of these other things like special editions, foreign translation deals, all of these things are awesome and I'm so happy for them. But just on a basic level, seeing people interacting with my book and being like, oh, this is really cool, I really loved it, and engaging with the story that I wrote, that for me is like a kind of magic, really. You know, I don't think it'll ever get old. I'm just, every time I get a little ding on Instagram or something and someone's raving about the book, like, I just, it's really gratifying, and it feels like all the hard yards kind of paid off in the end. So yeah, it is really exciting. I mean, is it kind of scary and intimidating? I'm not really finding it is, but I have felt a little bit like that writing the second one. I definitely have had the imposter syndrome with the second one, which is kind of funny, because like I just, with the first one, I spoke earlier about the kind of just like silly, ridiculous confidence I've always had in my own writing. So I did the first book, I just never like really had the imposter syndrome thing, but I definitely had it with the second one. I was just like, I went through a tricky 2 or 3 month phase a few months ago where I was just convinced that it was just shit. Like, it was rubbish. It was terrible. And I was just like, I must've just like fluked the first book, and this is terrible, and everyone's going to realize I'm a fraud, and it's just, you know, my career's going to be over. So that went on for like, I think a lot of writers go through that. And I feel like, I know Joe Abercrombie has said that he's gone on record as kind of saying that he has hated every single book he has written at some point in the process, and been convinced that it's terrible and it's going to end his career. So I was kind of like, well, if it happens to him, then, and he's okay, so hopefully
there's
I'll be
no
fine.
No hope for the rest of us.
Yeah. So I'm just kind of like, hopefully like I'll be all right. I've just got to, but I think in those moments, you just have to kind of power through. You just have to kind of just trust yourself and be like, no. And also just remember, like, the first draft is kind of meant to be rubbish. Like, you know, it's not going to be awesome, is it? It's probably going to suck, and that's all right. So I got through it in the end, but like, yeah, at those moments kind of doubt yourself a little bit, and the imposter syndrome kind of creeps in. So I haven't felt pressure with the first book coming out, like, neither during the course of writing it nor it being published. I've not really felt any pressure there, but I for sure have felt it with writing the second one. But I think that's just part of being a creative person. You have moments when you feel like you're not sure about what you're doing, and you're not sure if you can do it, and you've just really got to just crack on and just keep going. I think it's the most important thing, just keep putting one foot in front of the other and just kind of tough it out and hope that at some point it'll all kind of come out in the wash or something. So second draft, I'm just clinging to that second draft. I'm like, this is where it's going to become good. I'm going to believe it.
That's where I fix it.
Yeah, well, first you get it down, then you get it right. So yeah.
That's a very applicable circumstance for that British sort of mentality that we were talking about before we recorded.
It's like,
keep calm and carry on.
We've come full circle.
The dumpster fire will be doused, don't worry.
Yeah, no, sure.
Shut up.
Sure.
Oh man. All right. Well, on that fantastic note, we will close out. If you could give listeners and viewers a good bit of soundbite writing advice, and B, tell us a weird or random fact that you find to be utterly fascinating.
I think for writing advice, I think the most, I mean, there's a lot of writing advice out there, which I think is just terrible because it assumes a one size fits all kind of approach, which is just not how writing works. Everyone has their own process. I think the most important thing is to learn what your process is. And I think the reason I struggled, the reason it took me like 4 or 5 years or however long to write Silver Blob is because I hadn't learned my own process. You know, I didn't know what worked for me and didn't know what didn't. And now I do. And I've really sped up so much as a writer. So what I would say is kind of don't pay too much attention to the writing advice that's out there. Just try and figure out what works for you. That I think is the most important thing. And then also try and finish what you start. So you get that entire kind of start, middle, end kind of sort of lesson, I guess, which is something, as I said, I think I wish I'd learned that a lot earlier. So yeah, those are the two things that I would say. Oh boy. So what was it? A fact, an interesting fact.
Yeah, random fact.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's kind of keeping on the topic of rogues. I wrote both my dissertations on Caribbean piracy, the golden age of Caribbean piracy, which is just super interesting. I guess like a couple of interesting facts kind of about that. I suppose I would say like, it really was like what's interesting is like it's become like pirates and stuff. It's like such a massive pop culture thing. But what's really interesting is like the actual golden age of piracy was like only about 15 years or something. I can't quite remember the exact dates, but it was like 1710 to 1725 or something. It's a really short period of time. And obviously like the century before that, you had like the Spanish Armada and the Buccaneers, and they were kind of like the forerunners. So you had that kind of piracy thing going on. But the golden age of piracy, as we think of it, like Blackbeard and all those kind of guys, like this was like a real 15 to 20 year period. And like it's kind of insane, like when you think about what a short historical time period that is, and yet the impact it's had on pop culture even to this day is like so massive. And I just feel that's, it's just hugely disproportionate, right? Because it's like such a small time period and yet such a huge influence. And the other thing I would say linked to that, I guess, is like it's just fun because so much of what we think we know about piracy is like just Hollywood invention. So like walking the plank wasn't a thing. Like that's made up. Like there might have been like one or two kind of incident, like isolated incidents of it that were just kind of one-offs, but as a thing, as like a kind of an actual thing they did, it, like that's just completely made
or
up.
Like
the
importance of like the captain. It's like,
yeah,
most pirate ships were actually like democracies.
Yeah.
Actually held as much power as the captain.
This is something I might talk a bit more about in the kind of conversation, the next conversation. But like the kind of charter they had, like it was incredibly democratic, more so than the actual legal merchant ships and stuff. In many ways, it was fairer. It was more democratic. And then, so you're kind of left thinking, who are the bad guys here? Like, you know what I mean? Like I find that really fascinating by how democratic, and obviously you don't want to kind of sugarcoat it too much. I mean, these men were kind of, and they were mostly men, but like they were pretty brutal and pretty rough and ready. But the way they lived their lives and the kind of the values they based it on were incredibly egalitarian. I just think that's fascinating. It's such a juxtaposition when you think about it, like in terms of the life they led, but the rules they had, like just don't kind of add up. But like, that's super interesting to me anyway.
Yeah. No, the mythology of pirates just kind of took it in like directions.
Exactly.
That's the magic of Hollywood, isn't it?
It's the magic of story. It's storytelling, isn't it? Yeah. Storytelling.
Oh man. All right. Well, James, thank you so much for chatting with MJ and I today.
Thank you. It's
an absolute pleasure.
Same.
And congratulations on when this episode comes out, I believe it'll be out in the UK very soon, and then soon after in the US. So go get yourself a copy if you're in the mood for Lies of Locke Lamora with Indiana Jones. And so if that's your flavor, go get it. Enjoy. And for anyone who contributes to our Patreon at $10 or more each month, you can hear a reading by James from The Silver Blood Promise. So go check that out. And James, if you could please let everyone know where they can find you online.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm pretty much on I'm mainly on Instagram these days. So James Logan Author is my handle on Instagram. Same for Blue Sky, same for Threads. And then Twitter, I still have my ancient username, which is Spec Horizons. So, but I'm not on Twitter too much these days. I'm not a huge fan so much. So Instagram is where you can find me, and also my website as well, jamesloganauthor.com. So do check it out.
Awesome. And you can also follow SFF Addicts on Instagram, Twitter, Threads, all that stuff at SFF Addicts Pod. You can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. You can also pick up my novel, Mushroom Blues, if you're in the mood for some fungi and some body horror and some detectives. And MJ, where can people find you?
Yep, you can find me across all socials, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, all of everything, at MJ Kuhn Books, all one word. Or just go to my website, mjkuhn.com. And if you sign up for my newsletter, you get a free story. So do that. Free stuff.
Blue and the green babies.
Enjoy. Oh, yeah. And then go buy the not free stories and so I can feed my cat. Okay, thanks.
The Thorin Fund.
the Thorin Food Fund.
Yeah, go support the TFF.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's it for this episode. Stay tuned next week for part two with James for our mini masterclass on writing thieves and rogues in SFF. Now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.